tuned to Perspectives, a weekly public affairs show which airs every Saturday right here on KTEP. Good afternoon. I'm Louis Sines, your host for Perspectives, and joining us today is David Cantwell. David is the author of the recent book, Merle Haggard, The Running Kind. Merle Haggard's an incredible person. If you're not familiar with him, Okie from Muskogee, The Fighting Side of Me, all those songs have been part of Mr. Haggard's repertoire. In fact, he has enjoyed artistic and professional triumphs a few can match. He's charted more than 100 country hits, including 38 number ones. He's released dozens of studio albums. Before CDs. Another half dozen or more live ones, and performed upwards of 10,000 concerts. And recently, he's performed with artists as diverse as Lynyrd Skynyrd, Elvis Costello, Tammy Wynette, Willie Nelson, The Grateful Dead, and Bob Dylan. And also recently with he was with Paul McCartney at the Kennedy Center. So with us again, as I mentioned, is David Cantwell, and he is the author of the book, Merle Haggard, The Running Kind. David, thank you so much for being with us.
Well, thank you very much for having me on. I appreciate it.
And let me ask you, first of all, because for people who may not know your work, this is not your first country book. You have another book, Heartaches by the Number, is that correct?
Right, it's Heartaches by the Number, Country Music's 500 Greatest Singles. I actually co-wrote that with a colleague of mine, Bill Friscus Warren. And in that book, we tried to tell the history of country music, basically at the history of country music through some 500 of its greatest singles, starting with the very first commercial hit in 1923 by Fiddlin' John Carson and going on up into the 21st century.
Heartaches by the Number, how difficult was it to do research for a book like that?
I wouldn't describe it as difficult at all. I mean, it was a lot of hard work, but it was also, it was just so much fun.
Cause, yeah, I was going to say, it sounds like a lot of fun.
Yeah, we got to listen to a lot of great music, and when you're making the selections about what gets included and what doesn't, you know, those are pretty, those are fun picks to make, even if some of them are hard, even if some of the records you wanted to include winded up outside the book. But yeah, and we really weren't in that book trying to, you know, make any sort of serious claim that our number one ranked song and our number 500 ranked song were the official answers to the question of what are the greatest country songs, country records ever. But we were trying to say that, you know, here are 500 singles that sort of tell the story of country music from its beginnings in the 20s, when Western music like you're talking about, and minstrelsy, and some Tin Pan Alley, and of course all sorts of folk music, and the blues are sort of coming together and are finally being recorded and sold to this white working class audience that, as you say, is even today is still the number one genre. Right?
A lot of these stories, and I call them stories because they are stories, and I would imagine that a lot of these songs are, I would say, 90% or more autobiographical.
I don't know. It obviously would depend upon the artist as to just how autobiographical a particular song is, but they are definitely things that I think, you know, almost any person could relate to. At some point in someone's life, they're going to go through those kinds of stories. When I was a kid, you're right that I listened to Top 40 radio, but I was growing up in the late 60s, early 70s, and there was a lot of times when, you know, right after the Beatles or Stevie Wonder, there would be a Glen Campbell or a Dolly Parton song, and all those songs were mixed up. And when I was young, I remember I liked the sound of a lot of those country records, but I was also sort of thrown by them because they seemed to be about such serious stuff. And at the time, I probably would have even thought they were kind of corny. You know, people who are getting divorces or who are trying to work hard and can't pay the rent, those sorts of things that as a kid I didn't really want to hear about. But country has a well-deserved reputation through most of its history for being, I think, adult music, grown-up music. And whether the individual artist is actually writing from their own experience or, as is often the case in Nashville-produced country music, someone else behind the scenes has written the song, and they're singing it, the themes that it's getting down to are, you know, bedrock, working class, everyday, common person themes of, you know, how am I going to get through this week? Am I going to be able to save this relationship? How are my kids doing? You know, just, and that's the kind of stuff that everybody can relate to, even if it's not literally pulled from their lives.
Well, it's interesting, as you mentioned, that you grew up listening to rock and roll, and of course, Beatles and some of those other songs, and the rock renaissance period, which was the period when people said that the consumer was listening to the words, not just the music. And so there were messages getting out there about because of the Vietnam War and social injustice, etc. And you mentioned in your book that at one point you went in there to a record store and you wanted to buy War and The Fighting Side of Me.
Yeah. When I was, this would have been in 1970, so I was about 9 years old. And I went to, back then I didn't even go to a record store. You probably remember this. You could buy 45 RPM 7-inch singles at the grocery store. And so that's where I went. I went to the grocery
yes.
store. And I wanted to buy The Fightin' Side of Me by Merle Haggard. And they didn't have it. They were sold out of it, I guess. And this is another, this is again, I'd heard both War and The Fightin' Side of Me on the same radio station. So that's another example of how all of this was mixed up at the time. So when they didn't have Fightin' Side of Me, I chose my second favorite at the moment, and I bought Edwin Starr's War. And if your listeners know those songs, they know that those two songs are about as different, not just musically, but thematically, as two songs could be. Edwin Starr is saying, "War, what is it good for? Absolutely nothing." And Merle Haggard is saying, "If you criticize my country when it's going to war, then I'm going to go to war with you." And when I was a kid, the fact that those two songs were kind of arguing with each other didn't really dawn on me. I just thought both records sounded cool, and I still do, you know. And that the rock and roll influence of a record like War and of all the previous 20 years of rock and soul records that had come before it, that was bleeding into country music. And so I think there's a lot of quality. If you listen to The Fightin' Side of Me, you know, that's it's today remembered as the sort of iconic country record, but that's a rock and roll record. I mean, it's got a big, thick Telecaster lick on it that's played by James Burton, who literally within months would be playing with Elvis Presley in Las Vegas. And it has that burbling boom, 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 boom bass line that is so catchy. It was actually played by the same man who played a very similar bass line on Nancy Sinatra's These Boots Are Made for Walking. And so there, in that moment that we're talking about, pop and country and rock, it all gets mixed up, and it's able to sort of, that's one of the things that really drew me to Haggard especially, is that he was a country act who had incorporated some pop and rock elements, and it allowed him to have a conversation, sometimes a very heated one, with other records on the radio. And those conversations were just echoing ones that were going on around kitchen tables and at bars all across America in those years as the Vietnam War heated up, as civil rights came to a head, as women's rights emerged, and so on and so on. All that stuff is captured in Merle Haggard's music.
As far as the country music goes, and correct me if I'm wrong, because you're the expert on the country music. You wrote that Heartaches by the Number. Was Charlie Pride the first African-American country star?
Country star? No. There was actually a very popular entertainer named DeFord Bailey, who was on the Grand Ole Opry for years and years and years. He was a harmonica player mostly, and he would be on every Saturday night and was one of the people that Opry audiences listened for, just like they listened for Roy Acuff and Ernest Tubb and other people like that. But in terms of actually being like a major superstar hit maker, then yes, Charlie Pride was the man. And you know, with the with very few exceptions, Ray Charles had a few country hits. He had a duet with Willie Nelson, remember, Seven Spanish Angels in the early 1980s. And of course, Darius Rucker has had a few hits recently on country radio. But beyond those two guys and DeFord Bailey earlier, the list of people besides Charlie Pride is pretty short when it comes to country music.
A lot of people don't realize that some of these artists were writers first, like Carole King. She wrote some fabulous songs with her husband. Pleasant Valley Sunday, of course, that the Monkees made popular. But then later on with James Taylor, she started doing a little bit of her singing as well. And that goes the same for some country artists. And the one that comes to mind is Willie Nelson.
Oh, yeah. Willie Nelson had, you know, had been in Nashville for years and years and had written, you know, many, many great songs. He started, I don't know if it was actually the beginning of his career, but of course he played bass in Ray Price's band at a time when he was trying to get a foothold in Nashville. And, of course, he wrote songs like, you know, Crazy for Patsy Cline and other things. But then, yeah, you're right. He it wasn't until he probably had been writing hit records for other people for a good 15 years before he really began to become the Willie with the long hair and the braids and the hit records that we know today.
Now, when Waylon Jennings and the Outlaws and Willie Nelson came out, there was a different style of country that we saw. And as you mentioned earlier, Fight Inside of Me, you know, is basically you know, a good musical song. There are some great riffs there. There's some great bass lines, and it's just great music. But then at some point, some people, whether it be the media, the critics, somebody says, "Wait a minute, it's changing now. It's not the traditional country music that we're used to hearing, like George Jones or." Furlan Husky, all of a sudden now it's getting a little bit kind of crossover-ish, rock and roll, the Outlaws, and then Dwight Yoakam and stuff like that.
Yeah, you know, there's almost never been a time in country music history when there wasn't some vocal contingent of the audience saying, "Hey, wait a minute, that's not really country music anymore. It's become too pop." I remember... One of the great country music historians is Bill Malone. He wrote the first great country music history called Country Music USA. And he actually went to the University of Texas at Austin and did a PhD there. He's one of my real heroes. And I remember talking to him, and he was telling me, yeah, he was really disappointed when Eddie Arnold stopped doing the Tennessee Plowboy records in the 1940s and started to add piano to his records. And this is like, you know, he's talking like records that Arnold released in 1951, 1952. And that's pretty much been a constant story, is that every change that comes along in country music is greeted by people who are saying, "Hey, wait a minute, we like the old country music." And yet the music continues to change. You know, Merle Haggard doesn't make country music that sounds like Lefty Frizzell's country music. Right. You can tell that Merle has listened to a lot of Lefty, but his records sound different. And Lefty Frizzell's records sound different than Jimmy Rogers' records. And if you turn on the radio today, the records that they'll play on the local country station are going to sound a heck of a lot different than they sounded like when I was listening to country when I was a kid. I think that shows the vitality of the genre, that it's able to constantly, that it hasn't stayed the same, that it's been able to adapt to the needs of its audience as those needs have changed. And, you know, I would say that's what makes country music a traditional music. A lot of people, when someone says something like country music is a traditional music, they think what that means is that, well, country music is a music that doesn't change. The new music is like the old music. And I think that's wrong. I think what makes country music a traditional music is that it has constantly changed, but all of those changes have in some way been done in a way that's made them connected to what's come before. So we have this long chain of links. And, you know, it's very common that someone like Merle Haggard, for example, will always talk in interviews about his heroes. His music doesn't sound like those earlier people, but he sees himself as connected to them. The other night on the CMA Awards, you may remember, you know, Alan Jackson and George Strait got up and did He Stopped Loving Her Today in honor of the late George Jones. And, you know, that's on a show where the music didn't sound anything like George Jones' music. But that kind of a gesture is one of the things country music does very well, I think. It says this music that's new and sounds different is still connected to that old stuff.
You know, it's incredible that you mentioned that he stopped loving her today, because those are some very powerful words. And, you know, when just to show you how social media and MTV and everything has changed so much, I've played that song for some of my students, and I'll say, listen to the words, tell me what he's talking about. And the majority of them will say, well, they broke up. It's like, come on. Yes, they did break up, but for a different reason. And I'm not sure if this is right or not, David, but I heard that he had recently divorced Tammy Wynette, and that he was not getting it right. And the producer said, George, I need you to put a little bit more emotion into it. And suddenly Tammy Wynette walked into the production room, the studio, with her new boyfriend. And so he looked up and he saw her. He got a little bit teary-eyed and he started singing, and that's the take they used.
You know, I've never heard that story before, but whether it's true or not, it certainly rings true. It has, and you can hear that kind of emotion in Jones's voice. One of the things that I think is great about that record, and it's sort of emblematic of what makes records great, period, I think, regardless of whether they're country records or not, is that it's not just the words. You know, it's not even just the words in that melody, but it's the human voice, the way that voice phrases those words and inflects on this one and pauses before that one, and how the voice and the words in combination are sung over a rhythm track. And on that particular record, how behind him, you know, those strings begin to swell at the end as his soul rises to heaven, and that angelic choir comes in. And all of that works together to create meaning that maybe on the page, it really would seem like, well, they broke up. But when you listen to that record with that voice, those words, that arrangement, it seems like so much more. Yeah, you're right.
Okay, getting back to Merle Haggard, and of course the book is Merle Haggard, The Running Kind by David Cantwell, and it is put out by the University of Texas Press, University of Texas at Austin Press. And David, I was telling you that I really enjoyed reading the introduction, and this is shortly after 9/11, and I was wondering if you would do us the honor of reading that segment.
Oh, sure. Well, I'd be glad to. This is the introduction to my book, and it goes as the singers say, and it goes a little something like this.
Okay.
On the Friday after terrorist attacks murdered thousands, crashed four airliners, and reduced New York's Twin Towers to rubble, Merle Haggard played a concert in Kansas City, Missouri. The instant he took the stage, he was pelted with requests, demands, really, that quickly coalesced into an impatient chant. Fight inside, fight inside, fight inside. It went on and on like that, the fans yelling at the singer for what seemed like forever. For his part, Merle had the look of a man who knew full well what it was going to be like this night, but he was irritated and disappointed just the same when he found out he was right again. He sighed. For just a second there, the hag appeared not like a star at all, but like the old man he was, vulnerable and a little frail. At 64, then, he was only half a decade or so beyond having had his arteries scraped clean by angioplasty. He looks small, too. Merle stands 5'7", but needs cowboy boots to do it. Most of all, he looked world-weary and a little put out by all these people screaming at him, as if they really imagined they could order him around. Hadn't they been paying attention to the words they'd been singing all along with all these years? Not even his own mama had been able to tell Merle Haggard what to do. Haggard shook his head slowly from side to side, and like so much else in his career, the gesture might have been interpreted in a number of ways. Was he telling the audience that he planned to play what he damned well pleased, no matter how aggressive the requests? Was he expressing disbelief at the audience's enthusiasm for him, or disgust at his fans' insistence upon a fight inside he seemed, just then, unable or unwilling to muster? Was he merely shaking loose the cobwebs of one more day spent staring out the window of his tour bus? Or was he maybe wishing he'd never stepped off it, longing instead to be back on board a Silver Eagle that was so small and known and comfortable that it felt like home sweet home, but that felt like a prison cell as well, and for the same reason? Merle didn't speak. He just leaned into the mic and started to sing. Silver wings, shining in the sunlight, roaring engines headed somewhere in flight. They're taking you away and leaving me lonely. Silver wings, slowly fading out of sight.
Thank you very much. Now, as far as Merle Haggard goes, and some other country artists as well, we've learned, and you've shown us in your other book as well, the fact that these men and women have lived rough lives. I know that in one of the interviews, because NPR did the top 100 American songs of all time, and one of the songs was when they interviewed Dolly Parton, and she was talking about the fact that, you know, they were just singing about living up in the hills of West Virginia and Appalachia and coal mining and all that stuff. And so these were just, again, stories that they were telling to each other.
Yeah, and I think that that's one of the great things about that Haggard, what he chose to do there in the passage I just read, is that, you know, he took a song, Silver Wings, which was the B-side of his Working Man Blues single in 1969, and was able to recognize that here's a song that I told to tell one story about the loss of a loved one who's leaving me back then. And he recognized that that story could be repurposed to that moment just a couple of days after 9/11 when those silver wings were all too reminiscent of what had happened earlier in the week. I'm sort of struck now that I'm thinking about that how, you know, that's something that, one of the powers of pop music is that it can sort of take those personal stories, just people singing their personal story one to another, but can give them the power to speak for a nation or to a community in that way, where just that one person's personal story becomes a national narrative that is necessary in a moment like that.
I know that this may sound like we're caught between a rock and a hard place, but some people may wonder or may assume, are country songs traditionally more patriotic than other songs? Especially after events like 9/11.
I don't think that, if we look at the big picture, I don't think that that's true at all. I think that, you know, George M. Cohan and Irving Berlin wrote plenty of patriotic songs,
sure.
You know, back around the time, back even before country music was a commercial genre. And Woody Guthrie, has country connections that I would classify more as a folk artist, had, you know, patriotic songs. But what I do think that has happened is it's country music, especially throughout the World War II and through the Korean conflict, and then in the early stages of the Vietnam War, country music was very addressed the war quite directly in ways that I think a lot of other of the pop genres didn't do at the time. But it tended to tell those stories tell personal stories, like you were talking about before. The losses were personal ones. So, like, for example, in the Korean conflict, Gene Shepherd and Ferlin Husky had a big, big hit called Dear John, and it was about a guy who was, off fighting in Korea and gets a letter from his fiancée that she's going to marry his brother instead. That's the way that country music would typically address the war. It wasn't really anti-war, but it was just talking about how difficult war was for those people on the front lines and on the home front. In the middle 1960s, Loretta Lynn had a great record called Dear Uncle Sam, where she writes Uncle Sam and says, look, I know you need my husband for the war effort, but I need him more right here. And again, it's not really necessarily an anti-war song, but it is definitely a pro people on the home front song and the difficulties that they're enduring. But then by the time we get to Haggard's Okie from Muskogee, and particularly his follow-up single to that, The Fight Inside of Me, something begins to shift, and country music songs begin to not just express the losses of the families and the soldiers and the difficulties, but actually begin to stand up for the war effort, fight back against those who would say we don't need to be over there, wherever over there is at any given moment. And so I would say that since then, country music definitely, maybe it's not more patriotic, but it certainly is more, or rather less tolerant of criticisms of the war effort. I can think of, not just before the Iraq War started, the Dixie Chicks had their big moment when Natalie Maines in London said, just so you know, I'm ashamed that to be from the same state as the president. But at that very moment, people oftentimes forget, they had one of the biggest country records in the world, Traveling Soldier, which was about, a young woman whose boyfriend has gone off to the war, and now he's come back home, but he's come back home in a casket. And the song is about that individual loss. That was much more typical of what country music has done, had done throughout its history. The reaction to her statement, I think, was much more typical of what country music has become, particularly in the 21st century. My own sense, though, is that the music, the songs that are more personal are the ones that last. I think probably, there are lots of 9/11 songs that came out in country music. Toby Keith, Darrell Worley, various other people had those. But the one that really sticks out with me is Alan Jackson's, Where Were You When the World Stopped Turning, which is not, pro-war, against war. It's trying to get down, say something specific about the loss that everyone's enduring.
Well, David, we want to thank you very much for taking the time to be with us here today. Unfortunately, our time has run out, but we've been speaking with David Cantwell. The name of the book is Merle Haggard, The Running Kind, and you can get it on Amazon.com. You can go to the University of Texas at Austin Press, and of course, any other bookstore, and buy this great book. David, thank you very much for being with us here.
Oh, thank you so much. I had fun.
If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song that I'm singing be a warning. When you're running down our country, man, you're walking on the fighting side of me. You're walking on the fighting side of me. Running down a way of life our fighting men have fought and died to keep. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song that I'm singing be a warning. When you're running down our country horse, you're walking on the fighting side of me.
Perspectives is taped and produced at the KTP Studios, University of Texas at El Paso Communication Building. Our thanks to our engineer and producer, Dennis Wu. You've been tuned to Perspectives. I'm Louis Sines.